Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
I'm Sheldon Bergson. I heard that name was available, so I took it for today. No, I'm actually Scotty Zahertz. Here are the controls.
That's a spoiler for later. Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. You can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to cfru.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today, we'll be journeying once again into that nebulous and noble conversation piece known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. All 12 countries, including Canada, have now signed the deal. But if the polls are to be believed, a number of you are saying right now, what's the Trans-Pacific Partnership? So we will talk about it later. Then we will look at the Whitby-Oshawa by-election and talk with Greg Vanzina, who is the leader of the None of the Above party. And that's not to be confused with Above the None of the, who is one of 12 people running to fill the seat vacated by Christine Elliott in the provincial riding. Greg will be coming up at 5:30. And then finally, we're going to be trying to dedicate one segment a week to a Guelph issue. And this week, we're going to be talking about the QP negotiations that are beginning at City Hall. As of this Friday, it's three unions covering about 700 employees in all, and they are poised to begin. They are poised to begin bargaining against what might be a very hardline council in order to get a new contract. But first, Iowa. That happened. In keeping with the theme of the most unpredictable and unconventional presidential race in ever, the results of the first actual vote have shaken up all expectations once again. And in case you were caught unawares, it was a practical tie on the Democratic side, with Hillary Clinton getting 49.9% and Bernie Sanders getting 49.6%. On the Republican side, it was Ted Cruz with 28%, Donald Trump with 24%, Marco Rubio with 23%, and then everyone else coming in single digits. Since Iowa on Monday, Martin O'Malley on the Democratic side has put his campaign on hold. On the Republican side, Rick Santorum, Mike Huckabee, and who was the other one?
One possibly more. Ben Carson, but no one's sure.
No, that's a,
where
that's
is he?
No, that's one, an entirely new. John one, Kasich is the other one.
No one knows where he is. Like, what?
No, not Jake. John Kasich. No.
Oh, Matt. Yeah,
Santorum, Huckabee.
We lost a few.
And Rand Paul too.
Ah, Rand Paul.
Although Rand Paul didn't finish it last. That's what had me confused. Rand Paul finished like fifth, but he's put his campaign on hold as well. And then all eyes are going to be turning to the New Hampshire primary, which is on Tuesday, I believe.
Yeah, I think those events have already kicked off. It sounds like they're sort of shaking it up in New Hampshire already, like already almost instantaneously moving on to the next thing, because you have to be right on top of these things. I heard one report that they had stormed the state, that the people are in there just sort of shaking it up already to try and get things happening. Interesting results. The whole sort of caucuses system is an interesting thing that we don't really have in Canada.
Yeah,
and
it's
when they were
bizarre.
I can't remember where they were explaining it, but it does seem very democratic to me in a lot of ways. What doesn't, though, was the Saunders-Clinton ties being decided by a coin toss, which is a, you know, I think pretty sure coin toss, if it isn't in the rules of order, it's definitely, you can decide a Major League Football game in that on a coin toss. It does happen. I know you can in soccer for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But FIFA's another story. Two heads.
I don't think we want to compare.
Two heads or two tails.
Especially when there's talk about corruption.
Yes.
In the process, on the Iowa end, talking about an organization that's horribly corrupt. But
it's statistically really hard to win six out of six coin tosses, but it seems it happened. Bernie was like, well, I loved it. He's like, well, statistical tie. It is essentially a tie by the numbers. It was 0.3%, I believe, last I'd heard, dividing
well,
them.
Well, yeah, and Iowa works. You know, it's not an all or nothing state, what they call an all or nothing state.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody gets a share of the delegates.
Yes.
Who placed. And so basically, Clinton and Saunders are getting half the delegates.
Yeah,
each.
Clinton was 23 and Saunders was 21. So that's ridiculously close. And on the Republican side, too, it was. You know, speaking of ties, I think when it all shook down, Trump and Rubio had the same amount of delegates, which I believe was 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some sort of weird sphere called the – oh, and Cruz was 8. So it's not exactly, you know, Cruz is the reigning champion, I suppose, but he's really only like one delegate ahead of the of second and third place. But yeah. It's strange too, and there's something called superdelegates, which are just out there. I'm not even really sure how that works. We'll find out for you. But Clinton has a ton of those, and Sanders not too many. They may be the difference between who gets the gig and not.
If I remember correctly, superdelegates are kind of malleable,
mm-hmm.
where you can kind of negotiate for them if – anyway, yeah.
So they've already pretty much moved on to the next thing. I think South Carolina is another one too where they're kind of stirring it up.
Mm-hmm.
Cruz is already there as people have been there, and Rubio has – I think it was the only – black or African-American Republican in the Senate has endorsed Rubio. And this is supposed to be a big deal because that'll really help him. Supposedly, I don't know. I don't know what's going to help. I don't know what's going to help any of the Republicans. And I'm not sure what's going to help Hillary either because that was – I think she was surprised. I think even Sanders was surprised at how that went down. But it's indicative of, you know, it's not just going to be the cakewalk that Hillary Clinton thought it was going to be.
She was definitely surprised because I heard that there was going to – at the victory speech, there was that all the Clintons would have a turn speaking, Chelsea, Bill, then Hillary.
And the grandkid – no, I don't know.
I don't think the grandkid's old enough yet.
No, I know, but it just sounds like
but
we're pulling out all the stops. The babies are going to –
but no, what ended up happening was Hillary was the only one that spoke. The Clinton campaign's going into New Hampshire where, you know, Bernie Sanders is not from New Hampshire. He doesn't represent New Hampshire. But I guess if you're from New England and you go to New England, you are family. I guess that's how that works. So.
Even though when you hear Bernie speak, he's still all Brooklyn,
he's still
right?
Brooklyn to
so
the bone.
Funny. Oh, my goodness.
So it seems like he has a lock. I think he's 33 points up on Clinton according to one poll. So he's likely going to take New Hampshire. The thing with Bernie though is what's he going to do after that? Because I think there's been a lot of chips put on winning Iowa and New Hampshire, and then hopefully banking on the idea that. That momentum would carry him through to the next batch of states, which is like South Carolina, Nevada, and then Super Tuesday mm-hmm. on March the 1st. And that's a big question mark because it's not so much about momentum on the Democratic side so much as the ground game you've got going on in the organization. And I hate to say it, but, you know, Hillary Clinton has that money. She has that money in the bank. She has that ground game. You know, as soon as 2012 was over, her people were – in all the precincts, trying to line up the board in her favor, and I think as much as some people on the Democratic side want to, you know, feel the burn, as they say, you know, Clinton might have the last laugh just because she's worked hard to get here.
And that's the thing with the first set of caucuses.
Cockeye.
That's cockeyed, I tell you. That's something somebody in Iowa would say.
It is the Hawkeye state.
Love you, Iowa. But anyway, they come strong out of the gate. I think in the past, too, a lot of the sort of Republican types do well in Iowa and then just fizzle completely. It's like, yay, Iowa.
Last 2 years in a row. Because who dropped out this week? Santorum and Huckabee. Mm-hmm. Who won in 2012 and 2008? Santorum and Huckabee.
Yeah, so it's changed. Whoever lined up on whichever side of the room, which I thought was interesting. Okay, you're with him. Go over there. It's like, wow. I don't know. So, yeah. So Iowa over with it, – the numbers definitely will change. I did a lot of talk with Sanders in terms of – and I'm not sure where that it's coming from, the whole, well, he's not really in with the black community. And there's just all of this stuff coming out saying, well, he's, you know, he did really well in Iowa, which he wasn't expected to do.
Notable that Iowa doesn't have a lot of black people.
No, exactly. But so it's easy enough to say that. You could say that about every candidate because Iowa doesn't have a lot of black people. And probably – I don't think New Hampshire does either, really.
No, I don't think so.
Vermont doesn't have very many people at all. It's like least populous. It's the less population there than Kitchener, I think, in the whole state, right? So – and that's his home – well, his adopted home state, but it doesn't matter. And it seems for the Republicans anyway, there was a record turnout of Republicans to vote in that. It was up
mm-hmm. –
I think it was about 50,000 up from – yeah, I think we went from 121 to 180,000. That's huge.
Well, this is,
or as Trump would say, huge. But
and this is the saving grace from that Trump was trying to spin initially, that, you know, he got the highest number of, you know, votes ever, even though he came in second. That was before, though, he's been hitting the election fraud card, in that the Ted Cruz campaign sent out some kind of mailer, some kind of email statement that Ben Carson was dropping out, and so yeah, everyone who's going to support Ben Carson should switch to Ted Cruz. And it's all based on the CNN story that
supposedly didn't exist. From
no,
what
no,
I
it existed, because
like,
I was actually watching CNN when it broke, either on Twitter or I was actually watching CNN. But they said Ben Carson was leaving Iowa immediately to go to Florida to take a bit of a rest before continuing on with the campaign. And then for some Ted Cruz staffer, according to them, took it to mean that he was planning on dropping out, even though the statement really didn't say that at all.
No, it's pretty specific.
But Donald Trump is taking it to mean, oh, Ted Cruz is trying to defraud people. I mean, that, you know, you're going to believe that or you're not. And that they should do the whole Iowa caucus over again, because...
And he blamed the media too, right? It's the media's fault. I came in second, or pretty much tied for second. I don't know.
But you know what's weird? I heard some analysis. I can't remember. It was on a podcast I listened to. But some analysis said because the caucuses are out in the open, there were a lot of people who did not want to be seen caucusing for Trump, who might have voted Trump if it was secret ballot.
Yeah.
But when you had to stand there and raise your hand when they call for Trump and you raise your hand, people didn't want to be seen voting for Trump. And I know this is the United States we're talking about. You got to ask yourself, what kind of country would vote for a person if they didn't want to be seen voting for him? And this isn't the first time we've heard this either. There was a somebody crunched the numbers and said that if it was a robocall taking a poll,
somebody would vote robocall.
If it was a robot taking a poll, someone was more likely to say they were voting for Trump than if it was a human taking the poll. So it's, we like, have this weird thing where, like, the guy who's, well, he's not the front runner anymore.
We're embarrassed by Uncle Donnie, but we support him anyway.
Yeah. It's like,
I don't know.
It's like, well, I like what he's saying, but I can't be seen with him. I just, you know, I might agree with him, but geez, he's just too much. He's too much.
Yeah, and you wonder how much of a difference that would make, though. I mean, is it a large? I guess it's impossible to calculate because they're not doing it. I'm just going to very quietly go Santorum and walk away. You know, that kind of thing, right?
I'm not sure that's much better.
No, but they would just, that's what people do, right? You have all these choices. You just pick whomever and go sit in their corner for a while or however it works. And then, but it all, it seems that with this caucus have moved into the high tech era, and that there was some kind of app. The results were instantaneous. It wasn't pieces of paper. It was like, boom, okay, they knew right away who had won, who had lost. I think there was a little fine tuning with the coin tosses. A heck of a lot of coin tosses.
And there were some paper ballots.
They're going to start using a coin toss app, maybe, and then they won't have to. They won't even have to do that.
I'm not sure that's better. But
no, probably not.
But yeah. So looking forward, New Hampshire is next week, and then it is Nevada for the Democrats and South Carolina for the Republicans on the 20th. Nevada for the Republicans on the 23rd, South Carolina for the Democrats on the 27th, and then Super Tuesday, which is about 13 states in all.
Yeah.
13 states and territories, because I think American Samoa votes that day too. Huh. So, I mean.
Sorry at laughing at you, American Samoa.
pulling for those Samoa delegates.
These protectorates in Costa Rica.
But still, I mean, it'll be interesting to see who can make it all the way. Certainly John Kasich, who was one of the quote-unquote credible, you know, mainstream Republican candidates, he's come out and said that New Hampshire is going to be his Waterloo. If he doesn't do good in New Hampshire, he's going to be gone. Carly Fiorina, she's been cut out of the next debate, even though I think she's the only one cut out of the next debate. Ben Carson.
Resting comfortably.
Resting comfortably. and then, yeah, Chris Christie, who, like Huckabee and Kasich, and Fiorina got 1%, and Rick Santorum got 1% of the vote in Iowa. He's going to stick around for a while. And then there's poor Jeb, who, you know, has his 3%. But, you know, this was the guy who was going to take it. You know, he was going to be like the mainstream choice. He was going to be the Romney. People were going to see the light at some point. And for some reason, that seemed to be transferred to Rubio, even though I'm not sure. If you look at them closely as politicians, you can't really see the
It's just weird.
The connection. So, yes, it's not getting any less weird now that there's voting going on. And I think that's the gist of it. All right. We're going to talk about something that is also weird, but in a different way. And that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You may recall that this was the agreement was finally reached during the election, our election, last fall. 12 countries in the Pacific Rim area, including the United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Japan, Vietnam, and others, due to change a whole ton of trading issues in the name of free trade. We're talking about 40% of the global economy. But nobody seems to know about it. Mm. And this is, I don't know whether this is because of just it was negotiated with such tremendous secrecy or it's like too heady. It's like, you know, the trade and the tax loop gap and the counterfeit da-da-da-da-da, and it, like, nobody knows.
It's just leaking out.
It's, yeah, it's just, it's you know, if you go and read it, it's legalese. It's this meandering, 6,000-page document. But this is the startling thing. Only 60% of people in a poll done by Leger for Lead Now had heard of the TPP, and 53% didn't know what was in it, like, even in a cursory basis. Like, they couldn't even say what was in it. 53%. That is kind of scary.
Those are painful numbers.
Yeah.
I think the last poll I saw in terms of support of it, people supporting it, was 32%, which is – that's sort of in line with what the conservative vote was generally. That seems to be where the support is coming from for it and the lobbying for it. And they were trying to use that as a plank in the election. Everybody just kind of went, what?
Yeah.
TPP, the Liberals promised a full and open debate, which we're still kind of waiting for. Now, there's going to be a 2-year-long ratification process. I'm not even sure how that works. It's like, okay, we're all going to fly down to New Zealand to sign it, and then we're going to spend 2 years hacking it out to see what's what on it.
That's the weird part in all this, because people heard it was being signed today, and Tom Mulcair got up in Parliament and made a big show of it, like, anyway.
How dare you? I missed it.
But they signed it today, and apparently it's up to every country then to ratify it. And I guess they just
a minimum number of ratifications that will make it legal, right?
I think everybody has to ratify it.
I thought it was over half, but yeah, I don't know.
But basically, yeah, but so I'm not sure how this works. Everybody signs it, I guess, just to prove that we all agree. I don't know why they couldn't have done it, like, maybe in the first place when it was completed back in September. But yeah, nothing is set in stone yet. Every country has to figure out on its own how to implement it. And I guess that comes through the ratification process. But yeah.
And that's the thing with the secrecy. We're just – and it is – you normally hear conspiracy types saying, oh, it's a secret deal, but it's a secret deal. There was that great picture of the protesters with the arrow pointing at the hotel saying TPP, secret deal being negotiated here. Nobody knows anything about it. And like I said, there's stuff trickling out about, you know, who is going to get a cultural exception for what, and are we still going to be able to maintain Canadian content to some degree? We have to give that up. And the auto sector, too, was another one. The ratios of parts for cars is going to change, and as to how much of each, and that would affect, well, directly considering, you know, our major manufacturing is auto parts.
Yep.
What's left of manufacturing in Guelph is auto parts.
Yep.
So there's been predictions here and there of job losses. It's entirely possible. But no one seems to know. There's numbers out there, 50,000. And Jim Balzilli chiming in again today. He already did once before, saying, you know, this is going to be tragic for the tech sector, and particularly the innovation area.
Yeah.
He's like, well, you know, you waited this long, and now you do this, it's going to be a disaster. So.
Yeah, and to be fair to Liberals, Christina Freeland has been doing public consultations about it. I don't think they've been fully public. I think it's been like public meetings with like business people.
More so than the Conservatives.
It's not like
who did nothing. You did nothing.
Yeah.
So getting a little. It's a bit better. It's marginally better.
Well, it's marginally better in that they're having meetings about it. And this is so weird, like Barack Obama is so had, you know, so gangbusters for it. It just strikes me as odd. But the fact that it was negotiated in secret and that you know nobody was privy to details. I'm surprised people even knew what hotel it was being negotiated in. Like, that's how stringent the secrecy was. And
probably just ask the cleaners. Probably they'd say, oh, they're here.
Oh yeah, maybe.
That's what I would do.
Well, you follow all the guys in dark suits and earpieces. Yeah. You're probably gonna
say, excuse me, where's the TPP meeting?
Yeah.
Oh, we don't call that. We have a code name for it. Enigma. Yeah, something like that.
It's Operation Eagle's Fall.
Yeah.
No, or something stupid like that. But,
what's the password? Caviar. I don't know.
But yeah, they're saying that at the very least that there's flexibilities in the agreement to ensure some protections. But, you know, some countries are more on top of this than others. New Zealand's apparently priced out how much it's going to cost them. But on the other hand, New Zealand seems to be one of the countries that's sitting pretty after this. There's a tremendous doubt whether how good Canada's going to be sitting after all this has passed. And a lot of it – and it's not just about trade either. This is the vexing part. And I believe we've touched on this before when we talked about this. But, you know, there's weak privacy standards provisions in there, stricter takedown rules for things online, expanded border controls, limits on data collection. And, you know, if you need a reason to say, hold on a minute, let's think this through. You have Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who is not exactly a pro-labor guy,
no.
Saying that this has serious problems and it shouldn't be pursued. And then on the other hand, you have Elizabeth Warren saying, you know, this should be rejected and it should be a major issue dealt with before the election. So you have the progressive left and the hawkish right both saying, no, this is no good. And yeah, I find it odd that anyone is trying to move forward with this, both here and in the United States, that, you know, we're being shown a piece of paper and saying, okay, you know what, you can maybe change some commas and some periods and some parentheses, but, I mean, this is the book that we're going to be doing business out of with all these countries.
Yeah, Paul Krugman came out and he said it's pretty much an intellectual property and dispute settlement service thing. It's nothing, you know, it's not – there's a trade agreement which everybody's – you know, you expect that. But then this is more along the lines of, you know, to me anyway, and of course I'm coming from that progressive side saying it just seems to – enrich the corporations in terms of the control of whether it's information or product or whatever. It's like, how can we please the job creators, let's call them. But it sounds like, and Bernie Sanders was talking about it today as well. I believe it was on Democracy Now, our 11 to 12 o'clock show that you should catch because it's a good one. And he was saying similar things in that as you know, we're giving all of this up. It's all the stuff they've been talking about for years. The jobs will go elsewhere. And then what are we left with?
Yeah.
You know, everybody's working at KFC for $7.65 an hour, right? That's the impression I get from this. In that it's and you know, of course, not just physical things of manufacturing, the as you were mentioning about intellectual property and data and that kind of stuff. It's just like it's all about control of that, whereas, you know, you would hope there was a certain amount of freedom in that area, but you know, right. What will be the nitty gritty? It's like if you're sharing photos on your Facebook, do you got to pay somebody a nickel? Like, I don't know. Is it going to come to that?
Well, this is the weird part.
We don't know.
It's a trade agreement, yeah. But there's a huge section about copyright term extensions.
Yeah.
What does that have to do with trade? No, it has nothing to do with trade. What it's about is protecting it's about protecting Mickey Mouse.
And
basically.
Yeah. And pharmaceutical patents as well. So yeah. Canada occasionally toys with the idea of national pharmacare. You do hear it in a lot of circles, doctors and otherwise. But that if the patent process – I mean, we're not talking about Shkreli levels of soaking people. But that you know, it used to be those controls would expire and then people could make generic equivalents. And then, you know, the poor people who can't afford it, which is most people, can't afford certain drugs, could get access to them. Well, it sounds like that's going to change too. This is big pharma right in there. The foot of big pharma, among others.
If you're really interested in this, Michael Geist wrote a tremendous series of articles where he dealt with key provisions in it and explained it, I think, really, really well. Because, like I said, it is a 6,000-page document. Nobody's going to sit down and – well, somebody might, but –
Somebody will.
But the average Joe, like me and Scotty, is not going to sit down on a Saturday and pour through 6,000 pages of a
trade
agreement.
There was a time, but that time is long past.
Like, I have books. I have actual books I want to read. So, yeah, it's really kind of important that people kind of educate themselves and about what's going on. And I hope the liberals do follow with, like, more public consultations. Like, I want town hall meetings about this. Really, like I'm not saying Christina Freeland has to do like 338 town
hall
meetings.
Oh no, she should.
Well, I'm not saying her personally.
No, but they're
really
somebody has to vet the process, which is what they should have been doing beforehand. But I'm not even sure what's happened in the other countries. Like,
yeah,
you're saying New Zealand's right on top of it. Did they have little town halls and stuff talking about it?
Well, that's a good question.
Don't know.
That's a good question.
Because, if we're doing it in secret, and the United States is, you can bet your boots everybody else is, too.
But on the other hand,
suck it up. Trade is good.
Yeah.
Free trade's a theory. Theoretically, it's supposed to be great.
The flip side is there's going to be a net loss for Canada, the United States, where labor is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side is most of the countries that are signing this, labor is cheap.
Yeah.
So it's a benefit to them.
Sure.
And
we know what happens.
Right.
It's already happening pre this agreement. The jobs just go. They just go.
Yeah, for sure.
How's that for a happy note? It's true, though. You heard it here first.
We're all going to die.
That's
you
right.
Heard it here. Yeah, breaking news. All right. We're going to take a break here for some music and some PSAs. And then we're going to come right back with Greg Venzia, leader of the None of the Above party. He's going to talk about the race in Whitby, Oshawa, and what it means to stand as None of the Above. And we're going to have a lot more good stuff coming up here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
In 1974, making his worst mistake as Prime Minister, Pierre Elliott Trudeau sold out the country to the private banks. Learn about the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform at comer.org. This has been a public service announcement.
Wow, that's one of the wackiest CDs I think we've ever played. Anything that's remotely political that comes in, and that one has Stephen Harper's face crossed off on it, a little bit dated. Ha! But we played her anyway.
Well, not if you live in Calgary Heritage.
No, I guess not. We should send it to them. That band is called Canada Day, and that song was called Public Service Announcement. Seems this is the only one without swearing. Somehow we missed it. It came out in September, so check them out. And I can't remember what the heck website that was, he said, but check that out too. I don't know. Canada Day. We may play
comr.org.
We may play some more of it, but it sounds like everything's not fit for radio. But anyway, Canada Day, Whitaker. That's who that was.
Well, now you know. On with the phone with us there. Oh, God, word salad there. Sorry, people. Anyway, on the phone with us from the Whitby, Oshawa area is Greg Vezina, the leader of the None of the Above party. Greg, are you there?
I'm here, and you don't get no hockey tickets because it's Vezina.
Oh, Vezina, yes, Vezina. As in the trophy. Yeah.
After a guy named George.
Is he your people, or?
Actually, we weren't related before, but about four generations before.
Oh, there you go.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay. Everybody's related at some place, at some point. Right?
DNA reveals that the cup could be yours, I guess.
Sure enough. And I do apologize.
No big deal.
Although I should note I'm not much of a hockey fan, so
that's
not really a punishment. So, Greg, you are the leader of the None of the Above party. For people who may not have heard of your party, there is definitely implications in the name. Can you tell us a bit about yourself and your party and what you guys stand for?
Sure. Rather briefly, we believe in the three R's of direct democracy. So that's referenda and recall laws. and electoral and legislative reforms that give control of politicians back to local communities, so that you control the nominations in your riding, not the leader or someone in the leader's office or the party office, etc. So we don't believe in follow the leader to the slaughterhouse politics. We think we've been doing that for 150 years coming up in Canada and Ontario. And, you know, we have had many, many leaders promise us real democratic reforms and to promise to do politics differently. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, especially in the case most recently of Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne, doing it differently means doing it worse than anybody ever did it before, not better. Yeah, you may recall that Mike Harris won a huge majority, 82 seats out of 125, because he promised to keep his promises and pass a referenda law so he and all that followed would true. In other words, trust me. Well, we've trusted these people over and over and over. Switch, 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 switch. Nothing changes. It just gets worse. You know, 30 years ago, we didn't even have party names on the ballot. We actually knew who our MP or MPP was, and they actually listened to us. Now, they're like bobbleheads in the back seat of a dump truck going down a dirt road. All they do is sit there and bobble and do what they're told. They don't do what we want them to do. So British Columbia has both referenda and recall laws, and they've used them both successfully. First, when the Liberal government promised, as Jean Chrétien did in a federal election, no, we won't do that GST or HST, and they got elected and did it. So they petitioned a referenda, and they voted it back out. But people, you know, and also what happened is there's been three recall petitions organized. None of them were preferred, and people, you know, went all the way because the candidates just resigned. So the bottom line is we're about none of the above. We're not like the above parties. We're about direct democracy, and we want people to have that option on the ballot.
Well, having said that, I mean, that might be great if we're in a general, but this is a by-election.
So what difference does that make?
I'm just saying there's no chance to sort of overturn the government here.
Well, what difference does that make? There are many cases in history of not only this country but many others that the election of one representative has forever changed politics. In fact, you don't even have to elect a representative to do it. I wrote a book called Democracy A in 1993, co-wrote it with John Devereaux from the Toronto Star, and it was a bestseller, and it said the Conservatives then at 169 seats would have less than 8 seats the size of the Bloc Québécois, and the Bloc would be your loyal opposition, and the splits in the vote would screw everybody, and the Liberals would get three majorities in a row. The book came out, and we were absolutely correct. But in that book, I took a quote from Brian Mulroney, Prime Minister, and he said, when he was asked about all the years in politics, what the two most important things were. And he said, the first headline said, Brian Mulroney wins big majority. And the second headline said, Brian Mulroney wins another big majority, because nothing else matters.
Right.
So in politics, what matters is threatening their limousines and their paychecks and their indulgences and all the rest. And the only way to do that is if people start showing an intention to vote for somebody else. And it has to be somebody that's different. It's not the same. And that's fundamentally what we're about. And a by-election, in fact, is historically the place where messages indeed get sent to fat, happy governing parties with a majority, which is the case here. And by the way, history of Whitby, Whitby has a great history. Prior to Confederation basic revolutionaries starting and meeting there and emerging from there. It's one of the places in Canada where new ideas and new governments were founded. So, and you know, like in Manitoba with Louis Riel. So, no, I disagree.
Well, I kind of agree with you that, to me, the more the merrier. And it sounds like this by-election is pretty packed. We've got perennial candidate John Tremel, who's also running Guelph, Freedom Libertarian, Pastor, I think, and of course the other none of the above guy. But you probably don't want to talk about him because you've been maxed out on the sort of the splitting of the vote of the none of the above. So lots of choice is a good thing. Have there been any by-elections are notorious for not having necessarily debates and open whatever. Have there been any debates down your way?
Yeah, no. There was. I went to court over this on Tuesday. There was the chamber organized a debate at the town of Whitby City Council chambers. That involved four candidates, two of which are sitting with the councilors or regional councilors for Whitby. No conflict of interest there, huh?
Mm-hmm. No.
So I complained and said, if you don't stage another debate, I'm going to sue you, and I'm going to go to court and try and stop future debates. And then they did the same thing, essentially, was done with another debate on Tuesday. Now, I went on an emergency injunction motion telling the court that there's two huge changes that have happened. First, there's a big Supreme Court decision when the major parties got together on a Friday afternoon a few years in the 90s, and they rigged all the election laws to seize all the assets of the small parties, to make them run 50 candidates, to make sure they don't get subsidies, blah, blah, blah. And this case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled in that case that your right to run under Section 3 and the voters' rights to cast an informed vote under Section 3 are the most important laws of all, and no other law, including freedom of the press laws under Section 2, which can be taken away by Parliament with the notwithstanding clause, touch them, because Section 3 can't be taken away by anybody. Now, so I get to court trying to do this, and the lawyers for the Conservative Party shows up, and they cite a 1993 case of the Natural Law Party trying to get on a debate, and I said to the judge, first, this isn't different facts. We're talking about all candidates debate on public property. Okay, secondly, that case was overruled in the Figueroa v. Canada, which was the Communist Party case. And then I further cited two important things. First, that keeping us off violates the UN Human Rights Accord and charter that we signed and became signatory and ratified. And the Ontario Human Rights Code has just been changed to include creed, and creed under international law includes political belief specifically. But more importantly, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that any right you have under international law to which Canada is a signatory is a minimum charter right. So that means that they can't do it. Okay? I've been in court with these people for almost 30 years. I filed my first complaint about not being allowed on a debate in 1983 federal election when I ran as a Green Party. Okay, I went to the Supreme Court against CBC, TV, and Global because when I was chief agent and treasurer of the Green Party of Canada because the CRTC charged them with violating the Broadcast Act. The justice minister of the time got a very large political contribution, I suspect, although I can't prove, for the party, and declined to prosecute the first and only time in the history of Canada the CRTC has prosecuted a broadcaster. And so the CRTC came back to me and said, would you proceed as a private citizen? We will intervene to protect our constitutionality of our regulation, and we'll protect you from legal costs. And again, the court made a very unwise decision that was subsequently overturned, but not directly, because there's been no direct on-point case. And that court said, believe it or not, that a partisan debate, a debate is not partisan, is not a campaign contribution or an expense, and the broadcasters don't have to provide equitable coverage as long as there's two people there. So the conservatives could bring a conservative and a communist guy and keep every other party off, and it's not partisan. So now here we have the Supreme Court of Canada saying Section 3 rights are the most important, and we have the Supreme Court of Canada saying that rights that you have under international law are your minimum charter rights. So the bottom line is, I'm in court after the election. I'm going to try and overturn the election results as it being unconstitutional. I've already filed the claim, and I'm going to the Supreme Court in Canada to stop this foolishness, but more importantly, I'm filing a complaint on the new Ontario Human Rights Code, and I'm filing a complaint with the United Nations in the next week or 10 days. In fact, I'm being interviewed by the BBC Worldwide at 8 o'clock tonight.
Okay.
We're in good company.
Yeah. We're definitely on top of the story.
Like them, actually said the names of some of the other parties.
Well, I mean, it is impressive when you get 10 people on a ballot, and it certainly speaks to perhaps a mood in Whitby Oshawa to try something different. So just as a resident of that area, what are citizens like you looking for in electing a new representative?
Okay, I don't live in Whitby Oshawa, but I have business interests there. My research company, which builds hydrogen ammonia-fueled cars, has a number of research projects going on at the university there, joint projects, over 3 years, six projects with a budget of $500,000. Mm-hmm. So, you know, anybody that lives or has a business interest in a riding has an interest in the riding. But, you know, there are local issues that are important down there with respect, you know, for example, the new methanol-ethanol plant on the waterfront, and, mm-hmm. you know, and for, you know, 407 toll fees. And, you know, every local community has its localized issues. Mm-hmm. But if you keep sending backbench MPs to government who are bobbleheads, then you're not going to accomplish anything. Honest to God, the people of Whitby Oshawa could accomplish more by sending me there for one term than they could accomplish unless they elected a premier or prime minister. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise they have no say. And in this case, you know, it's a former conservative riding, so right. If the conservative wins, it is a backbencher in the middle of nowhere. So the bottom line is the most important issue to me is sending a message to our politicians that we've had enough, but it's not enough to change your name to above Z, none of thee, and have people waste their vote. It's got to be a positive answer. There has to be a way to fix it. There has to be some belief, and, you know. And so that's what we're about. I've spent 35 years of my life fighting for democracy in Ontario and Canada, going to court, writing books. I owned Online Direct, the largest internet company here, online polling, Vote Direct. We polled 500,000 people in the 1998 election, and Elections Ontario, Canada told me I had to shut my poll down, so I moved it to a server in Florida and said, here, go sue someone in Florida. So I stand up, I put my money up, and I ask for my rights, and for 35 years they've been denied, and I've had enough. And now I and every other person who runs for office in Canada are going to have their Section 3 constitutional rights, and every voter in Canada is going to have the right to hear and see what they say on public property, including the public airways. And I can't see anything wrong with that. And keep in mind, I never asked for 10 people to be on the same stage.
Mm-hmm.
All I said was, if you give something to some, you got to give something to all.
Mm-hmm.
Precisely.
Nothing. And there's no definition of law that I could find in any dictionary, even in communist Russia, that says equitable
mm-hmm.
or fair means all for some and nothing for others. And any electoral system that gives all to some and nothing to others is not constitutional.
Well, Greg, we're kind of running out of time here, but thanks so much for joining us today on these
Absolutely.
Public airwaves. Best of luck to the in the election.
Thank
and
you.
We hope to hear from you in the future sometime.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care. Thanks a lot. All the best.
And once again, that was Greg Vezina. Did I get that right that time?
Vezina Trophy.
Right. Greg Vezina.
We got to watch some hockey there.
Evidently.
Yes.
He is the leader of the None of the Above party and very passionate about politics.
Absolutely, yeah. You can feel it.
Yeah. We felt it.
Yes.
And I know Scotty's passionate about this issue, labor issues, labor unions, labor negotiations.
That's how I first end up in this chair, actually. So.
Yep, working week. Shout mm-hmm. out.
Yeah.
So Guelph is going to be negotiating new labor contracts with three locals of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, the 241, the 973, and the 1946. So that's your outside workers, your office workers, and your library workers. Their contracts expired on when was the first, Monday or Tuesday?
Oh, my goodness. Monday, yes.
So now they're working without a contract. Negotiations start tomorrow, actually. And I think, given the current makeup of council, it's not perhaps a secret that this might be a contentious one?
Yeah, definitely. Just for a point of clarification, I am a member of QP. I'm not a member of any of these QPs. I'm not an executive or anything. I'm just a working guy who happens to be card carrying. Just wanted to clear that up so you don't get the wrong impression.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always these kinds of things can always be contentious, considering for the impression I got from the information I was able to get, and of course we're not getting as much information anymore from the paper, among other things,
right.
Is that they kind of left it a little late. In that, you know, these negotiations, and they are without a contract, but the way it works is that the workers will stay under the contract that they're on, and yeah. You know, it's not as if they're just, you know, hovering in space or whatever. Right. I did try to get in touch with the two locals inside and outside, and I should have tried the library workers as well, but they did not get back to me before airtime, so I was hoping to get some comment in terms of. Just what exactly is going on. Now, I know for a fact as a member that QP likes to keep its cards close when it comes to negotiating, so I don't think they would actually talk Turkey on any issues saying, well, we want this and that. They generally don't negotiate in the media.
Right.
And, of course, all we have to go on from the city is the press release saying, well, we want the best for the workers, but we also have to keep in mind that there's a budget, and so there's always the implication that, you know, it's going to be tough. But
I think Mayor Guthrie's exact words, I wrote them down here, to negotiate a contract that's fair to our employees, but reasonable and affordable for our citizens, and recognizes the city's capacity to pay. So in there, there's definitely a
tone.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah.
And that's where kind of this I don't know if you want to call it controversy, but what happened a week ago at the city council meeting, the closed meeting, that was what the closed meeting was about when they came out, opened the open session of council, and then had to go and finish their closed meeting, was coming out with a statement about the direction of the negotiations, and this was it. Yeah, we want to give everyone a fair contract. However, this is a city that spent 8 hours trying to cut, mm-hmm. and got down to 2.99 tax increase, and still it was a close 6.9 pass, mm-hmm. or 7.6 pass at the end of the day. So, I mean, we haven't actually seen too much labor strife lately. We saw the thing last, or 2 years ago now, with
the bus,
with the ATU, mm-hmm. right? But the last time there was trouble with QP really was, like, I guess 2010, and that was the year we had the Karen days, the quote-unquote Karen days.
Well, they were
days.
Locked out, though, right? That wasn't a strike. Well, they were locked out.
It wasn't it was like
a lockout.
It took 5 days.
The Karen, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of like Ray days, but.
Right.
Yeah.
So they got 5 days without pay, which meant the city was essentially closed for 5 days.
And, yeah, what the end result of that? We're here now. I don't know. I'm not totally convinced that these things work, and especially with the Ray days, I think they PO'd a lot of labor by doing that. Is it the best way to create a savings? I don't know. And generally, the way these agreements are going, not just with QP but with others, is that you can never ever really – this is just me speaking as worker guy. You can't really strike on wages anymore. There was a time – in this world where you could totally strike on wages because they were so poor. Now you pretty much just see cost of living, and not even cost of living. I think the previous raises were something in the realm of 1%. I mean, that's not a cost of living raise. It's just you're getting 1% more. And the argument always is that, oh, I didn't get them. He's my angry conservative voice. I don't get a raise. Why should you get a raise?
Well, no,
but
exactly.
It's not like they're getting – the impression that's given is like they're 5%, 10%. You know, those – you just don't see those kinds of numbers anymore. So, if anything, it won't be – wages will be the sticking point. It will be something else. It'll be, either staffing levels or something to do with the pension and who can be pensioned off and those kind of other benefits, which also account for the, let's call it the total compensation package.
Right.
That's where the savings is to be found. But, the whole.
Well, the pensions, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're a labor guy, but the pensions is what management is always talking about killing the where the drainage is going, because you have more people entering the pension system all the time.
Well, in some respects, yeah, but pension systems are always under attack. The city, I believe, I'm not sure if all three locals are, but they're covered under OMERS,
right.
Which I believe is a fairly healthy system. It's it's a good pension to belong to because it's kind of independent of the unions of the city. It's just taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say it's sort of an independent body, whereas a lot of older pensions, like mine, are just sort of like a bank account where both parties dump money.
Yeah.
And they're not very, you know. And then there's the teacher's pension. Don't send us hate mail, teachers. Your pension is awesome. And I'm of the mind that, you know, pretty much every – I don't know if the Ontario pension plan is going to pick up the slack and fill that gap. But, I mean, you know, some pensions are stellar and some aren't. And I get the impression the city one is okay. But it's not – you know, they're not maxing the city out because they have this, right. this pension deficit. And part of the problem with pensions as well is that there's a clause – a wrap-up clause, because there were so many companies going bankrupt and pensions disappearing, that supposedly the company or group, and it includes institutions as well, have to have enough money on hand, theoretically, to be able to pay everybody out with their pension.
Hmm.
And that creates this sort of illusion that they need to have this back. We need to have this many million dollars on hand, and we don't have that, so we're screwed. So we have to chip away at that. But it's something that law in particular needs to be looked at, because it works in the case of a factory that's never coming back, which we saw over and over again. But when you've got something like the city or the university or institutions like that, you know that the institution isn't going to disappear overnight. The university is not going to pack up tomorrow.
Right.
But yet they have to have this amount of solvency behind them, which is this mythical number that's this is no basis in reality. And there have been fights over that in places.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the timing of it, how it seems to be left last minute. There's another labor negotiation going on right now. The city's in mediation with the firefighters right now, and that's mm-hmm. kind of under the radar, I guess, because firefighters can't strike and walk off the job.
No, they're essential service. Yeah.
Right. But it's been over a year since the firefighter contract expired.
It's that long. Yeah, I wasn't sure. I should follow it closer. But yeah.
And the last time
– it's that long.
I mean, it's almost the exact thing that happened last time. The last time they finally passed a firefighter contract,
mm-hmm.
they had 8 months left on the contract because it's backdated,
yeah.
right?
And then it all becomes retroactive. Yeah.
Right. So that's – I mean, there's something weird about that. I mean, there's no commentary on who's negotiating what.
No.
But just, you know, when you finally reach an agreement, it's 8 months left and then you're having this
again. It's ridiculous. But part of it, too, is that they know that the firefighters can't and won't walk. So they'll just – they take their time because they're not going to go anywhere.
Right.
And I think in terms of remuneration and that, they do all right.
Oh, yes.
And I think probably anything that they would walk out over or at least, you know, do work to rule action or something over would be – I would think safety related and possibly pensions too, because believe it or not, I mean, firefighters don't and it's sad to say this, firefighters don't last long in their retirement.
Mm.
So there's a bit of a different structure in terms of, you know, what they get paid out for. I think both from a health and safety standpoint, but just it's just a different world in terms of health. It's the same. I'll say the same for the trades too, which includes me, in that, you know, you never hear about the old electrician, right? Like, we go early. How morbid is that for the wrap-up? No. But you know what it is? But no, these are the things that, you know, from an economic standpoint need to be considered, because and I'm not picking on the teachers again, but there was a report. There's a lot of 100-year-old teachers retired in Ontario. That's like a whole other lifetime from the day you hung up your chalk. So these kinds of things need to be taken into account. I believe the essential is the reason as to why, you know, and we've seen it in the past too, automatic declarations making certain things essential, like the TTC, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in my book and a lot of people's books, you're not really essential unless there's somebody's life is in danger. And that includes firefighters and police. And, you know, you can't just, no, I'm not going in today because it's not safe. It's people run into burning buildings and have firearms, you know, so it's different. But
send donation to the Guelph District Labor Council on Scotty's behalf.
Oh, my God. Don't do that. Where would my credibility go?
If we're planning for the end already, anyway.
Send us cookies. Send cookies to the station. And speaking of send to the station, just very quickly, André-Philippe Gagnon tickets for Saturday, February 13th, 8 p.m. available. Call the station. Call the station. These tickets will be yours. Two tickets, February 13th. André-Philippe Gagnon, Mr. Rubberface. What the heck was his name? The guy that he sang the whole Tears Are Not Enough or whatever in every single voice. Definitely worth checking out, so do that. call us when music is on.
Yep. And we will see you next week here on Open Sources. You can go to our website, opensourcesguelph.com. On Facebook, we are Open Sources Newswire. On Twitter, we are at @OS_Guelph. And, of course, find our podcast and of this episode and other episodes of Open Sources Guelph on Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. I am at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter. GuelphPolitico.blogspot.ca is the blog.
Scotty Hertz on Twitter, Scotty Hertz on Facebook, ScottyHertz@bell.net for email. And, yeah, contact us. We want to know what's going on. And Guelph stories. You got a Guelph story? We
yes,
will cover it.
Absolutely. DJ Sounds Good to Me is at the top of the hour here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next week for more Open Sources. We'll be right back.